You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello, and welcome back to the Dear Prudence Show. Once again, and as always, I am your host, Dear Prudence, also known as Mallory Ortberg. With me in the studio this week is Paola Dianan, a TV-obsessed HR professional from Northern Virginia. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for bearing with a couple of false starts. I'm so glad that we have finally got another HR person on the show because I feel like those are the questions that I get the most often that I feel the least equipped to handle, just in the sense of, like, sometimes I'll say either, I think you should go to HR, or I think you shouldn't go to HR. And I don't always know what I mean. Like, what does going to HR entail? How do you do it? What happens next? I realize I've just sort of said, like, go see the Wizard of Oz, and he'll know what to do. And that's just where it ends.
Yeah, I just kind of tend to give the advice of HR because I'm working in HR, so I tend to tell people that they will solve all problems. It's just kind of whenever there's a concern and if there's someone that you have to go above, just like your boss, if you've had a conversation, I tend to point people to HR. However, the problem with that is that not everybody has good HR. So It really just depends on, you know, who their HR is and what that HR department's kind of main concern is, because sometimes it's the company, sometimes the employee. So it really just depends.
Yeah, I was thinking of this especially because this morning in the live chat, I had two sort of like hiring or dealing with conflict among employees questions, both of which felt really intense. One of them was this hiring manager who was contemplating, they work for like a nonprofit that works with like at-risk youth. And they were like, I'm thinking of hiring this person, Janice, who would work with clients. And she has great references. But I know her to espouse her religious beliefs a lot. And I have heard that, like, to her former coworkers, she has made homophobic and Islamophobic remarks. But she's the best candidate so far. That actually felt pretty simple because I was like, definitely don't hire her. Like, yeah, this is not a conundrum.
Find more candidates. There's people out there that are not awful and still have good skills and education. So
It would be better to go an extra month or even a couple of months without someone in that position rather than hiring someone to work with at-risk youth who you know to be like a religious evangelist and bigoted.
Like, I don't even know how that can even be a question of like, should I hire this person? No, they sound bad. You should not hire them, please.
Yeah, I think it was one of those things where when you say it out loud, you realize there's not actually a conundrum of any kind. So that was a pretty easy. But the other one was even trickier. It was somebody who looks quite young. And is often like in the workplace referred to as like kind of infantilizing nicknames by other women, like not
sweetie,
not in a
like sweetie,
sweetie, kid, short stuff. Yep. and like it, in fact, went so far recently at like an office party, one of their colleagues had sort of drunkenly taken a glass of wine out of their hand and said, like, kids shouldn't be drinking wine. And then when the letter writer was like, oh, I am not a child, I'm 22, the colleague demanded to see her ID.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And then she brought it up to her supervisor because she was feeling quite, understandably unnerved by this. And the supervisor said this woman lost both of her children in a drunk driving accident a few years ago, sort of as if to say, so we should all let this slide.
Yeah, that makes it okay.
Which is just obviously that's very painful. I can imagine that that would just be something you would carry with you for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. But also, that's not good behavior at work.
No, it's not. And that's kind of tricky because if it was like at a holiday party, sometimes the rules can be a little bit different because it wasn't necessarily like on company time, but that person sounds mean. And
yeah, Is it different? Like, I mean, if it's an office party, even if you're not technically working, like it is a company event, right? Like it's not.
Yes.
It's not like, oh, we just all happen to run into each other at this bar.
Right. Like if it's a company sponsored, that's who's paying for everything. That's who invited you. And that's why you're all together.
Yeah. But yeah, I do feel like that is a person who should probably go to HR. I think actually my advice was definitely go to HR. Especially because it's such a pattern.
Yeah, no, I mean, especially if that, obviously it's something that happens really regularly that she's getting comments about it. So I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I look young for my age as well. Mm-hmm. So I've had conversations, not with HR, but like my manager about, hey, other people think that I'm very young. And sometimes I think they doubt my ability to do things. And it sucks. So please fix this.
I think it's rough when people do that in part because like, it's, I mean, obviously like there are things that a person can do in terms of how they dress or present themselves, but like assuming mm-hmm. that that's all controlled for, people can't help how they look. If you look young, if you're very tall, if you're, you know, kind of fill in the blank, that's just sort of how you look. And it's, I think often people will write in and say like, people say things about this to me all the time, as if I don't know what I look like. And in a way that is really tiresome. And it's just like, yeah, that's just what information are you trying to impart to someone when you say things like you look young? Yeah. Like, what can they do with that information?
Exactly. There's nothing productive that can come from you telling me this.
Right. Right. So if nothing else, anybody who's listening, if you work with someone who looks young, don't tell them that.
Yeah.
Because they can't do anything with that information. And time will come for them, you know, as it comes for us all.
Yeah, pretty
much. Eventually, the withered hand of death will reach out and touch their countenance.
I'll reach, like, I'm probably just going up real slow, but once I get to the top, it's probably going to be a very steep fall.
We all get there, or we don't, in which case that's sad in a different way. All right, well, now that we've like, opened with death and degradation.
Yeah. I'm very happy now.
this is sort of the theme of our first letter, which I feel a little bad for leading in with such a jocular tone. So I will switch to a more somber attitude and just start reading this letter and move on. So the subject line here is sick at work. Dear Prudence, this summer my father died unexpectedly. The weekend after Thanksgiving, my niece was killed in a car accident. Since then, I've been experiencing migraines and increased anxiety. I've had to miss a lot of work due to this. I filled out medical leave paperwork recently, since I also had an anxiety attack at work. I'm an ICU nurse, and I don't want to leave my unit. However, I realize that I'm not doing as well as I thought I was after the death of my loved ones. At my yearly evaluation, my manager said that she thought I should look for another job, not due to how I'm performing at work, but due to all the sick time I've had to use. She suggested I apply to another position within the hospital. I feel like she didn't give me much choice. I don't know what to do. This is just causing more anxiety in my life, and I'm trying to get better. This is tough.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, like, letter writer, I'm so, so sorry. And it makes a lot of sense to me that you are not, like, immediately back on your feet, just like, I'm doing great. And I think it is hard when there's that sort of push and pull between I'm not operating at, like, maximum functionality, but I also don't want to, especially if I'm doing a good job when I'm at work, I don't want to feel like I'm being pushed out of my position when I don't feel like that's necessary. And it was a little unclear to me. I don't know if you had a particular read on, like, did you feel like the boss is offering a kind of unwanted suggestion, or the boss is kind of saying, you need to start applying for other jobs because I'm considering letting you go?
So the way I took it was the boss just, like, a very insensitive, not thinking comment that was like, hey, maybe, I guess, you know, I'm taking a lot more from it that maybe is there. But I took it as them just not thinking about it and saying, maybe you should try something less stressful, or, you know, maybe you should try something that, you know, maybe doesn't require full time, but still is not something I think you should say or bring up unless the employee brings that up to you, which it doesn't seem like she did.
If that's the case, do you think it's worth the letter writer going back and saying, hey, I want to make it really clear. I want to stay in this job. I love this job. When I am able to be here, I'm doing really good work. My goal is eventually to, you know, I'm not taking sick time. It doesn't sound like they're taking, like, more sick time than they're entitled to. I'm kind of curious if this is simply they have been using all of their sick time and there's kind of a culture of don't use your sick time. But it doesn't sound like you're making mistakes or you're taking off more time than you're entitled to. So I think my instinct would be to go back and say, like, here's what I want, which is to continue doing this job. I do not want to transfer jobs. Can you help me do that? Like, can we work together on this goal?
Yeah, no, I actually wrote in my notes that she really should go back to the manager and say, you know, going back to our initial conversation, you did recommend I apply to another position. I'm not interested in applying to other positions. I want to do my current position better. And that's what I'm hoping to do, you know, once I can really get my feet on the ground. You know, she's dealt with a lot of stuff. So for anybody to expect the letter writer, the nurse to, you know, be able to handle everything and just jump in back to work, like, you have to be crazy. So I just feel like there should be another conversation. Like, that should not be the last conversation that's held between them.
Yeah. So I think you have a lot of room to say this, letter writer, especially to just say, like, I feel like we didn't get a lot of clarity the last time that we spoke. I just want to reemphasize what my goals are. Like, the reason that I took that medical leave was to address my increased anxiety. I can't promise you that I'm going to be, like, fantastic tomorrow, but I am taking all the steps necessary in my own life to make sure that I can be at work when I need to be and do my job to the best of my ability, which I love doing. And that might be helpful too in just making yourself clear to your manager. And if your manager comes back with some concerns about your performance, or you know, reframes it as, yeah, I said it as a suggestion, but actually what I mean is you need to do this, at least then you would know, like, at least you would have clarity. And hopefully that's not your supervisor's response. Hopefully your supervisor says, okay, that's good to know. Let's figure out ways that we can work together to make sure that you can stay in your unit, given that that's your goal. And I'm just really sorry. Like, I'm really glad that you're taking the time off that you need to deal with the physical and emotional after effects of these two really profound and unexpected losses. That's a lot to go through in, like, a short time span.
So in regards to the sick time, I do want to say that typically if you are accruing any type of, like, leave, that's yours to use however and whenever you want to. So that's also something that the letter writer should keep in mind, is that, you know, if you're using your sick time and that's not what normally people do where you're working, that's, I mean, to be so harsh, that's not your problem. Like, you earned it. You get that as a benefit. You get to use it.
Yes.
So there shouldn't be any guilt about using your sick time. They shouldn't give you sick time if they don't want you to use it.
Yeah, I sometimes will hear about that from people, and I feel so much frustration with any kind of management culture that's like, here's your PTO, here's your sick time, better not use it. And if you do use it, we're going to, like, really kind of, like, bring the pressure.
Yeah. It makes me crazy. It's just not realistic to, I mean, these are humans that require sometimes to not be at work.
Yeah. People get sick. People.
Yep.
Especially, like, given that you work in, like, nursing. Your supervisor should know more than anyone that people get ill. And that when they're ill, they need medical attention, and they can't just go about their business in the same way. But yeah, good luck. I'm hopeful that this is something that will be improved by having that conversation and just knowing that it is okay to say those things and to clarify with your supervisor. I hope that their response is a good and supportive one. All right. Would you please be so good as to read our next letter?
Sure. The subject of this one is Nutty Friend. Dear Prudence, my husband and I are friends with another couple. We all went together to a bulk food health store. I was horrified to see my friend scooping up large portions of expensive nuts from different bins and munching at them as she walked around. She did not even buy any of the items she was eating. This is stealing. I walked away so I would not be associated with her, but short of not going into a store again with her, what can I do? She and her husband are not rich, but they live comfortably and can afford to buy most of the things they want.
So I laughed a lot when I read this because something not terribly dissimilar happened the first time that Nicole Cliff and I went to a grocery store together.
Oh, goodness.
And not on the same scale, to be clear. I sampled a grape, and her face when I did that was just like, she had never, I felt like I was the bad kid in a, like, after school special who was like, want to go shoplifting?
Oh my gosh, you are the bad kid though.
It was one grape. We ended up buying grapes.
I just felt like I should confess. I read this and I was like, when she said, this is stealing, I was like, it is stealing. I would likely scuttle away from embarrassment of the person that I'm with grabbing things out of the bin by the handfuls and chomping on them.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a real hypocrite having confessed already to eating a grape, but feel like large, like, handfuls of, I don't know, like, macadamia nuts, like, multiple times. Like,
it's gross also. Aside from the stealing, let's go back to the gross factor of this. Like, your hands are now, like, some poor macadamia-loving person is going to come up within the next 10 minutes to get their macadamia nuts, and they're going to have no idea that there were hands in there. And that's terrible.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. It's difficult because I would imagine her response to your saying anything would be something like, don't be ridiculous. And it's always hard when you're trying to tell someone that something isn't ridiculous and that's their only response. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's not stealing she didn't steal a car. But yeah, absolutely. You can say, you can definitely, it's not hard not to go to the grocery store with friends. And it's also fine to say, like, you should pay for that. And to just say it and, like, let it sit there. Like, you don't have to get into an argument back and forth, but just to say, like, yeah, you should pay for the food that you eat.
Yeah. I mean, as far as the what can I do, like, if she didn't, or, well, I guess if the person, the letter writer, didn't say anything at the time, I feel like at this point you really can't say anything. Like, this isn't a let's sit down and have a conversation a week later about the nuts that you stole a week ago at the grocery store. I just feel like that's just even more awkward than the nut stealing.
Right. You got to keep this in a sense of scale where, like, I think this would have been worth saying something in the moment. It's maybe a little odd to bring up later and might make things into a bigger deal than you would want to. But yes, absolutely. Don't go to a grocery store with her again. Certainly, if for whatever reason you have to and you see her do it again, you can say, like, you got to pay for those many, many Brazil nuts that you've just consumed, my friend.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. But the funny thing is as I was reading this, I would be the person that would be mortified and suddenly have to buy something and find something on the opposite end of the store. So I would not be next to this person with their hand in the bin.
There is 100% a version of reality where I'm with someone who does that. I don't say anything. And then when we're in line, I say to the clerk, oh, by the way, I had two handfuls of macadamia nuts. Can you charge me for that? Like, which
Please
is maybe sure. the worst possible choice because it's super passive aggressive.
Oh, my God.
And it's also a lie, which is just weird. But I can absolutely see myself doing that. Yeah, like, you know, I'm feeling really bad about that grape, by the way.
You should just take one of your grapes from your home and take it back to the store.
That does not seem commensurate. But yeah, like when I was a kid, occasionally when my mom would take us grocery shopping, we would be like, I want a banana. And she would, like, bring the peel with her up to the front and be like, please charge us for this banana that my children ate as we were walking around the store. So
right.
I don't know where I got that grape thing from, because clearly my mother did not teach me to behave like that. But yeah, if you're eating fistfuls of nuts, it's kind of gross and you should pay for them because nuts are expensive.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You are a good person, letter writer. You are an ethical person who is on the right side of history. Congratulations. Yeah. And, like, it would be so embarrassing if somebody had come up to your friend and been like, you got to pay for these.
No, that's exactly what I would have run away. Like, I can't even, I'm getting really uncomfortable even thinking about it right now. Just like somebody coming, I hate getting in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So
same.
If even a grocery store employee was to walk up and be like, hey, what are you doing? I would be mortified. I would ban myself from the store.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, I think we've handled this one, you know. By the way, I just got a text from my producer informing me that Berkeley Bowl, which is like a very, very fancy local grocery store, bans you for life for grazing, apparently.
It's an appropriate response.
But, like, do they put up pictures? Like, how do they remember you? Like, I feel like you could get banned for life and then 6 months come later with slightly longer hair and be like, I'm a different person.
No. Imagine the shame of having your face in a grocery store cash register because you're not allowed to go back because you put your hands in the bulk food section.
I feel like the kind of person who is grazing so conspicuously that they're getting banned for life might also feel, you know, up to the task of trying to sneak back in. Like, you might be dealing with someone that shame doesn't work on.
No, I can't be friends with rule breakers like that.
It's pretty intense.
It is.
You know, on there is a part of me that admires that sort of will to power. but I don't think that the world would be a better place if we all behaved that way. So let's leave it comfortably in the world of fiction. All right, this next letter. This is so. There's so many like fraught, multi-level friendship interactions going on right now, and yes. This one really leapt out at me. So the subject line here is simply accidental misandry or just being gay. Dear Prudence, about 2 weeks ago, my friends and I were watching TV together, and they started commenting about how attractive the male actors were. They're all straight girls, and I'm a lesbian. I'm out, and for the most part, fairly calm about it. I commented that I felt nauseated at the thought of interacting with most men because I thought that this was a common feeling. They started insinuating that I might have been sexually assaulted as a child, and then explicitly said that I probably wasn't quote-unquote really gay, most likely straight or bisexual. They kept asking me which men and women I would sleep with, even after I shut them down by saying, "Sorry guys, but unfortunately at the end of the day, I'm still gay." At the time, I brushed all of this off, but I keep replaying all of this in my head. Should I still be so bothered by it? Should I let this go or revisit the topic with them? Is it really that abnormal that I'm afraid of most men? I'm really close with them and I don't want to ruin our friendship. Woo!
So, her friends suck. I think it's like, why? What's with the questioning about like, well, are you really who you are? Like, that's what that is.
Yeah, I mean, to insinuate that somebody else has been sexually assaulted as a child is,
yeah,
I just cannot imagine why you would choose to speculate about that for any reason other than wanting to hurt someone.
There's no, yeah.
Yeah, and then to say that somebody isn't really gay after they tell you that you're gay and then repeatedly asking them, like, which people you would sleep with, that's awful.
Yep.
Like, I can see why you keep replaying this in your head, because I would keep replaying this in my head. This is really jarring and unkind and homophobic and invasive. And just like the implications of just like, I'm gay. No, you're not. Tell us which men you would sleep with.
Yeah.
That's dark.
Are you sure something didn't happen to you?
Oh, man. Yeah.
No. And it's just, you know, when the letter writer asked, should I still be bothered by this? 100% you should. Because, I mean, you would never think to ask a straight person, are you sure that you're straight? You know, it's just, I don't know how they could find that to be an appropriate question to ask and to push it so much. You know, to just keep going and keep asking about it after, you know, your friend has said, listen, like, this is who I am, drop it. And to keep going. Like, that's the worst part I find is that, you know, you already know that you've made someone uncomfortable. They've already said to you, this is who I am, be done. And they keep going. Like, that's not a friend. That's like not who friends wouldn't do that.
Yeah, and to a lesser extent, kind of your question of like, I thought what I said was going to be pretty like go without comment, and part of your question seems to be like, is it that unusual or is there something going on with me? Like, should I expect this kind of response from other people? And I would just say, A of all, I don't think there's anything that you could have said that would have justified the sort of interrogation that followed and the sort of like cruel speculation about how you could or should change your sexual orientation. Like, that's pretty you just could not have merited that no matter what you had said. You know, sometimes like in private conversation people work out feelings of anxiety or mistrust or intense feelings about things like masculinity and patriarchy that are not necessarily like the most fully articulated, formulated like thoughts. But again, just saying that like the idea of interacting with men is sometimes painful or nauseating for you. Even if they had wanted to kind of talk through like some different ways of thinking about that, you know, I think an appropriate response on their part would have been something like, let's talk a little bit about that. What is it like for you when you do have to interact with men and like mm-hmm. not now like we demand that you fantasize about sleeping with men? Like that's yeah. so yikes.
Yeah. No, I mean, if they thought like it was something more serious, approach it like it's something more serious. You know, don't kind of keep badgering and being like, well, what would you, what about this guy? You know, if you were, you know, what would you do with this guy? What would you say to this guy? Like, no, if you really believe that there's something serious that maybe happened or, you know, talk to your friend like it's something serious. I don't understand how it could just turn into this kind of, they were, it almost sounded like they were really jokey about it. You know, like it was kind of funny to them to make the letter writer squirm.
Yeah, and just in a way that like smacks of the sort of like corrective approach of like mm-hmm. we will bully or tease or cajole you into experiencing an attraction to men that's just really not okay. So I think part of the reason that you're replaying this a lot is you say you're really close with them. These aren't just like some people you kind of knew. And that's part of what's really hard. And you say explicitly that you don't want to ruin the friendship. And yet you had an experience with them that I think rightly has been sticking around in your mind because it was really homophobic. It was prolonged. It persisted despite, you know, your sort of attempts to like not engage with like this request to fantasize, and it was really invasive, and it's implied that it was bad from start to finish. So I think part of what's hard is if you let yourself really feel how bad this was, it probably already does ruin that friendship. And that's really hard.
Yeah, and I think a lot of like, you know, I'm really close with him and I don't want to ruin our friendship. I mean, I don't think the letter writer could really do anything at this point to ruin the friendship. I kind of think the friends really have done a good job of that. I mean, there is a chance of possibly talking, maybe the letter writer's closer to one friend over the whole group and they could maybe talk to them and, you know, say, seriously, you guys made me very uncomfortable. You know, sometimes it might be more comfortable to talk to one person that maybe you're closer to instead of address the whole group. So I would say maybe try to have a conversation with some or one of them to say, I didn't like this conversation. You made me feel really uncomfortable. You tried to make me feel bad about who I am. And I don't want it to ever happen again. And, you know, I'm very bothered by what you all said.
Yeah.
If they are close friends, if it's like a longtime friendship or, you know, really close, hopefully it was just a dumb, thoughtless thing that they did. And once they realize how much they hurt their friend, that they feel really bad about it.
Yeah. And it kind of does put me in mind with that last letter of like the ways in which when we are friends with people and they hurt us, there's that sort of panic of if I really let myself engage with the reality of what this person said or did, then I won't feel safe. And I really want to feel safe. And I want to feel like I can trust the people I love. And maybe if I just don't think too hard about it, or if I just remind myself that this person is a good person, it won't have to hurt. And not to say that this letter writer is in any sort of position like the person in the last letter, but I can understand that feeling of like, the implicit desire in this letter is there a way I can understand this where it wasn't really that bad, where they were just confused, mm-hmm. and where we can move on from this? And I don't want to say definitively that, you know, no one can ever find meaningful amends or repair a relationship where somebody has said something not just thoughtless, but cruel or dark, yeah. or that suggests a form of sexualized violence. But whether or not that is possible, it won't happen by you convincing yourself that what your friends did wasn't that bad, because it was really bad. So it's not just like maybe you were confused and I didn't really like it. Please don't do it again. I think the thing to say is like, hey, guys, you know, and again, you can absolutely do this one on one. But the thing to focus on here is I expressed to you a fear of men. And your response to that was, were you sexually assaulted as a child? You're not really gay. And demand that I tell you what men I would sleep with. That's like just saying those things out loud, it kind of makes it clear.
I was about to say, when you say them all in a row like that, like that is just terrible. Like that is so mean.
Yep. It's just awful. Not good. And if their response to that is some version of we were just joking or it wasn't that bad, you get to push back against that and you get to say, mm-hmm. here's how I experienced it. I expressed a fear and a vulnerability and you guys dogpiled on me in a really cruel and invasive and homophobic way. And I'm trying to tell you now how not okay it is. And if you keep doing that, then what that tells me is you're not really concerned about how I feel and you don't really care about my boundaries. And that's pretty important. And you know, I want to hope that their response to this would be serious self-reflection, even if it didn't mean you guys were going to be able to return to the level of closeness that you meant, but like really, really reconfiguring the way that they respond to other people's like thoughts and feelings about sex and sexuality and gender that might not, reinforce what feels comfortable and normal to them. But if they don't express a real, like, my God, I really need to look at myself that I would do this to a friend. If that's not their response, then that tells you something about how safe you are with them. And I do think you need to pay attention to that.
Yeah. And I do think there has to be a little bit of preparation on the reader, on the letter writer side to kind of start thinking that maybe these are not the friends that you thought they were.
Yeah.
So kind of start preparing for the fact. I mean, I'm not saying go into it thinking they're bad. I'm probably going to stop this friendship, but understand that that might be a potential outcome and it could probably be for the better. Open up some room for people in your life who aren't going to question and aren't going to push like that.
Yeah.
But I think it's scary to think like friends that you have that maybe they're not the best for you. But I definitely think that that has to be a reality that the letter writer thinks about if they, you know, decide to talk to them and say how much this hurt and how cruel it was.
Yeah. And I'm just really sorry. That had to have just felt so disorienting and bewildering to go from I'm watching TV with my friends to I'm expressing a real like painful physical response sometimes to the prospect of like talking about how attractive men are and the possibility of male violence to all of a sudden my heterosexual friends are all saying things like you're not really gay, you were probably assaulted as a child, and tell us what men you're really attracted to. Like, my God, like if that doesn't justify the like nausea and fear you were experiencing to begin with, I don't know what does. Like, you were literally like, as a gay woman trying to express something that makes you really anxious and uncomfortable and feel unsafe, and your heterosexual friends responded with the very thing that you fear.
Mm-hmm.
That's not friendship. That's just not.
It's really not. And I hope that the letter writer can find new friends that won't make comments like that, won't make you feel uncomfortable about who you are and how you feel.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, ultimately, not to sound so cheesy, but that's what friends are for, to make you comfortable and make you feel happy to be around them and not anxious and have to defend who you are. So
yep.
I hope they find better friends.
And I hope you do already have other friends in your life that you can talk to about this and who will respond really seriously and be like, that's really not okay. What do you need? Can I help you? Can I support you? Because that is just a really dark thing to have experienced. And I think part of why you're like, why can't I stop thinking about this is because in the moment, in part, I think to protect yourself, you sort of downplayed how painful it was just to kind of get through it and get out of there. And then afterwards, when you were actually in a slightly safer, like physical space, your brain was sort of like, hey, can we go back to this? Because this is really fucking us up. And it makes a lot of sense that this is replaying over and over in your head because it was surreal.
Yeah.
Okay. So we got one last question, and I think I just read the last two letters, so it is your turn, I believe, to take us home.
I will do that. So the subject of this one is, sorry for my Spanish. Dear Prudence, I was wondering how to approach the following subject with my friends. I live in a very Spanish-speaking part of the country. I moved here about 6 years ago, so I'd say my Spanish is pretty good. However, when I meet up with native Spanish friends, they always insist on speaking English with me and then going back to Spanish with their other friends, excluding me from conversations. They'll even go so far as to speak in Spanish to waiters and then making a point of asking me in English what I want, even though I'll speak Spanish to the waiter the whole time we're out together. I know my accent isn't great. I can't roll my R's like a typical person. But I've been practicing, but I can only produce one rolling R at a time. I feel very singled out when my friends insist on speaking in English to me in a very Spanish environment. I've spoken to my friends a few times about how I want to not stand out and only speak in Spanish, but the minute I make a mistake, they immediately go back to English. It makes me very uncomfortable. I know I can't be completely native here, but I would like to at least be seen like I'm not an idiot. I'm not sure how to go about this. I don't want to be angry at my friends because they're trying to be helpful, but at the same time, I feel very much like there's a neon sign over me that says token English speaking person whenever we go out. So, I would say yes, be angry, because you've told them a lot of times already that you don't like when they do this. You're trying to learn. I don't know how hard that is to understand. That someone wants to learn a language and not letting them practice is not letting them learn.
Yeah, I think the one thing that you do have control over here is whether or not you continue to speak in Spanish. And that is something that you can, you know, even if you, like, let's say you start out speaking in Spanish, your friends switch to English, if you make a mistake, you can keep speaking in Spanish. And I think that that might go at least some ways towards making you feel like you do have some autonomy in the situation, which is just insist on speaking Spanish. Just say, like, you know what? I just need to keep practicing and keep making mistakes. So whether or not, you know, I'd prefer that you guys would switch to Spanish with me, but I'm just going to keep speaking in Spanish because that's the only way I'm going to get better.
Yeah. And that's kind of the way I see it is, you know, if they try to talk to the waiter for you in English or they try to translate, like you said, just keep talking, keep speaking Spanish, and keep force your Spanish on your friends.
That's really the only way. And I don't think it's forcing. I don't think that that's going to be like a helpful way of looking at it. But just to say, like, if what I want in this country is to speak the language everybody else is speaking, I can do that regardless of whether or not the people around me are working hard to accommodate me. Like, I get to do that even if my friend tries to, like, facilitate my conversation with the waiter in English. I can actually just go ahead and address the waiter in Spanish.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just, like I said, I just keep on practicing and doing what, you know, what the letter writer should just keep doing, what they need to keep doing. And, you know, if you have to keep saying to your friends, listen, I need to keep doing this. Please let me keep doing this. Just, I know it will get annoying, but I think it is something that just has to keep being repeated in the moment. I don't know when the conversation's about, like, you know, when I've spoken to my friends a few times about it. I don't know if it's happening after the fact or if it's happening during, but I think it has to be one of those in the moment. Please let me do my own order, take my own order in Spanish. Please include me in the conversation in Spanish. I'm understanding it might just take me a little bit, but please don't stop speaking Spanish for me. But it has to be said in the moment so that the adjustment can be made and remembered right there.
Yeah. And I think there, even given that you've already had a couple of conversations and that hasn't been super productive, to just, like, quickly in the moment, just say something, say in Spanish, I'm going to keep speaking Spanish, and then just keep doing it. And, like, either they're going to look like kind of weird insisting on speaking English and, like, having you address them back in Spanish, or they will eventually pick up the program. And hopefully you do have people in your life. You know, again, it sounds like you've been living there for 6 years. You don't say that you have trouble, like, getting around or having conversations with people who haven't known you a long time. So it does not sound like your friends are, like, kindly trying to help you out when you are, in fact, not fluent. Like, it's literally just that they're not paying attention. They're not listening. They're not respecting your stated wishes. And that's really frustrating.
Yeah. No, I don't know why I would feel like they would be more excited that someone's trying to learn and try to be more helpful. But I think sometimes, you know, my family is actually from a Spanish-speaking country. So when we would go back for vacations in the summer, family friends would speak to us in English, thinking not that we didn't speak or we didn't know how, but they were trying to make us comfortable. And I know it was never done as a, oh, you don't speak, so we're just going to go ahead and speak in English for you. It was, we want you to enjoy your time here and be happy and comfortable, so we're going to speak to you in English, regardless if we were like, no, that's okay. Like, we all speak Spanish. It's okay. But yeah, so I mean, I'm assuming that they just aren't doing it to be jerks. I think they probably think they're making things easier, but in actuality, they're making things a lot harder.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially like the difference between somebody who's visiting for the summer versus somebody who's like, guys, I have lived here for 6 years. Like, yeah. Presumably you work in this country. Presumably you like go out and buy groceries on a regular mm-hmm. basis. Like you've been doing this a while. You've kind of made it clear what your intentions are. And I think it's just going to help to be like, all right, whether or not these people get on board, I'm just going to go ahead and keep living my life speaking Spanish in the Spanish speaking country.
Yeah. Just keep on with the Spanish. I mean, that's just going to help you more, letter writer. It's just going to help you keep learning and keep doing better. That way you'll be in more of these situations, unfortunately, or hopefully not, but where they're trying to translate for you and you'll say, nope, in Spanish. You'll say, no, I got this. Don't even worry about me.
I realize now that I did not have as many HR-related questions as I had sort of hoped that I would. Because there is not an effective, efficient friendship HR. Which is a real shame, because if there was a good one, okay. I feel like a lot of our listeners and readers could use one.
I would probably take a job in friendship HR if that was offered.
That would be amazing. Please, we should get on that.
Yeah. Please ask me your friend, work friend, or non-work friend related questions, and I will help. I will escalate the issue where needed. I would love to be friend HR. Oh, okay. I would love to be friend HR.
You know, I was thinking about, I don't know how familiar you are with like the old, like sort of obsolete job of a lady's companion, which was someone who would sort of basically be paid to be someone's friend. And I feel like if we could bring that back, we could probably get this friendship HR thing going. If we could really just be like, yeah, friendship is, we're just going to make that a job now. Oh, no, this is a capitalist hellscape I'm creating. I'm sorry. I thought it was like a fun old timey throwback. And then I realized that I was about to start charging people for acts of friendship.
Yep. Well, I don't know if you've seen, my mom recently sent me a video for professional people walkers.
Go on.
They walk people for companionship and exercise.
I mean, those are all great things, and I can imagine there are maybe some situations in which doing so in a professional capacity might actually be really helpful to somebody. So,
yeah.
Okay, right on. I like walking. Sweet. Walking is nice.
Professional people walker, friend HR.
Yeah, all right.
Just kind of my dream jobs.
We got to find some way to find meaningful vocation and to talk about acts of friendship that can use outside facilitation without introducing capital to it. If I can figure that out, then we're going to be set. So I will assign myself that task from this week till next. And hopefully by the time
Please do. I would love to hear about what you come up with. I would like to hop on board.
I'm sure this is a problem that just required my attention. Like, this is how we're going to solve it. Oh, thank you so much for coming on the show and for, you know, just being a beacon of hope for people who don't have great HR departments.
Thanks. Thanks for having me and letting me represent those people that work in HR that actually really love employees most of the time, because sometimes employees might make it a little bit hard to love them. If I'm being honest,
everybody brings something to the table. Life is a rich tapestry. I haven't said that in a while. Life is a rich tapestry. Thank you so much for being on the show. And I hope I get to have you back sometime.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Max Jacobs. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Don't miss an episode of the show. Head to slate.com/Dear Prudence to subscribe. And remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds, a minute tops. Thanks for listening.